Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 to 50, the 55th talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew, was presented by Ron Julian on March 10, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2019. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
This is my last week of teaching Matthew for a while. We're going to finish up Matthew chapter 12 today. We have three parts left to talk about. The first two parts are quite tricky, and who knows whether I'm getting close to what it is it's talking about. We'll see as we go along. The third part doesn't seem all that tricky to me. That's probably the part I'm getting wrong. So we'll start with the first part, Matthew 12, 38 through 42. So Matthew 12, 38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to him, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Okay, so in asking for a sign, I understand these scribes and Pharisees to be essentially asking for proof. They want an incontrovertible demonstration that God is with Jesus. I suspect that they don't expect Jesus to provide this proof. Luke says that they were testing him when they made this request, so I suspect that they were there was a certain element of let's put him in his place here. The sort of thing they were looking for, as I would understand it, is that sort of thing that you just cannot deny, like the parting of the Red Sea or Elijah calling down fire from heaven. One of those big things that you go, okay, I'll give you that one. God did that. He must be with you. Are they responding to the miracle that we already saw where Jesus cast out the demon? That was last week we were looking at that. And you remember that there are those among the Pharisees who charged Jesus with having cast out the demon by Satan. It's a little bit tricky to tell whether this group, it is a different group that's making this request. Are they making that request in response to that event or separate from it? The evidence is a little ambiguous, I think. But at any rate, they don't believe that Jesus has done anything so far that requires them to believe in him. They see it as his job to do something spectacular enough to convince them that they ought to believe that he's from God. Jesus responds by calling them an evil and adulterous generation, which is very strong language, speaking to Jews especially. He's saying essentially that their lack of belief is not because Jesus has failed to make a compelling case, that there isn't good reason to believe that he's from God. Their lack of belief is rooted in evil and adulterous hearts. Okay, so at this point, I want to step back for a minute and look at this idea that Jesus is talking to an evil and adulterous generation. In this section of Matthew that we're looking at today, Jesus points the finger at this generation several times. So we have this here. He says they are an evil and adulterous generation wanting a sign. He's going to say that the people of Nineveh will stand up at the judgment and condemn this generation. The queen of Sheba will stand up at the judgment and condemn this generation. And after Jesus tells a strange story about someone who goes from bad to worse, he says, that is the way it will also be with this evil generation. So he has his sights on not a particular activity of someone in front of him, something that somebody has said, but he is speaking to the generation. Well, I'm interested in trying to understand what sort of a thing that means. So I want to tell you how I look at what it is he's getting at here. What exactly is wrong with this generation of Jews? Are they worse somehow than the Gentiles around them? In comparison with the Gentiles, they're evil and adulterous. But just go next door and look at those nice, godly Gentiles over there. That doesn't seem to be the case. So I would like to make a series of points that I hope will clarify, at least it'll clarify for you how I think about what it is that he's saying here. So one, I think that we can make the case that in most ways that generation of Jews is no worse than the nations around them. It has always been the case in the history of Israel that it was a remnant that truly believed. In the past history of Israel, it was a remnant of Jews that believed in God. There are a remnant of Jews who will believe in Jesus. And there are a remnant of Gentiles who will believe in Jesus. Many Jews did respond positively to Jesus. I mean, we see it during his ministry. He got a lot of trouble, but he also had people who were interested in what he was doing and were arguing back with people saying, no, you're wrong. I think he's the Messiah. On the day of Pentecost, thousands of Jews repented and believed. And this continued throughout the rest of Acts and the New Testament. Both Jews and Gentiles responded to the apostles in belief, and both Jews and Gentiles responded in unbelief as well. The apostles were rejected and beaten up by both Jews and Gentiles. So, if you consider nations as a collection of individuals, both Israel and the other nations had a minority of individuals who believed and a majority of individuals who did not. So it's not as if Israel was somehow lacking in that comparison. I mean, they're kind of the same in that way. Two, I think that general statements about the nation must be seen in the light of promises that God made to the nation. God is dealing with Israel in a different way, in a way that is different than he does with anyone else in the history of the world. He takes the descendants of Abraham and he makes this unique covenant with them, this arrangement with him, with them. If they would be faithful as a nation, then God would bless and protect them in the land. It was a temporal arrangement. He was saying, look, I'm making this agreement with you. I'm giving you laws. I'm asking you to be faithful in doing what I ask you to do, to trust me in difficult situations. And if you do that, I will protect you. I will be your God. You will be my people. But this is an actual promise that, like, things will go well for you. Your people will live a long time, and your enemies around you will not conquer you. I will make sure that they don't, and all of that sort of thing. So there is this arrangement that God made with the nation as a nation. So individuals along the way may have believed in God, and that's great, but there's this other thing, which is the essential tenor of the nation itself. Is the nation responding faithfully to God or not? And as you're probably well aware, most of the time they did not, as a nation, respond faithfully. And so God brought judgment upon them. I always like to say that I think it's very important, especially for us in having 2,000 years of history where Jews have been treated very, very badly, that we stop and remind ourselves that it is not because they are Jews that they were faithless along the way. It is because they are human beings. What we see in the story of the Jews is God can part the Red Sea in front of somebody, and yet they still will not trust him. But, you know, I have some, I don't know, I'm a mutt, but I have some Irish, English kind of blood in there somewhere. So I think if he had chosen the Irish as the chosen people instead of the Jews, I feel quite certain that the story would have gone the same way, because that's the way human beings are. So all of us, individually before God, have this choice we have to make, and we will stand before our Creator ultimately and either find forgiveness and blessing or not. But there is this unique relationship that God has with the people, the nation of Israel as a whole. It says, and in addition to that, I am doing something with you as a nation. You guys stick with me, and I will stick with you. So we know it happened. They were not faithful, so God brought judgment. He did not bless and protect them in the land because, as a nation, they did not keep the covenant. So they were sent into exile. Later, God brought them back into the land, and this time, in the period in between the time of the Old Testament and the New Testament, there is a holiness movement that develops in Israel that emphasizes diligently keeping the law. And this holiness movement turns eventually into the party of the Pharisees. So now we have the religious leadership in Israel dedicated to promoting the idea that, you know, last time we didn't keep God's laws. So this time we're going to keep God's laws. This time we're going to do it. So what I'm saying is all of these are statements about the nation in general. How the nation is relating to God and relating to the promises that God made to them. Okay. My third point would be, it seems to me that spiritually, the nation is worse at Jesus' time than it was before Babylon. I think that is the case that Jesus is making and that we see time and time again. So before Babylon, they blew God off, ignored his laws, ran off after pagan idols. God accused them of adultery. The prophets used the language of adultery. It was as if God was their husband and they had been unfaithful by running off after pagan idols. So, for example, we read in Ezekiel 6:9, "Then those of you who escape will remember me among the nations to which they will be carried captive." So this is talking about the captivity that is going to come upon the people as a judgment in Babylon. "How I have been hurt by their adulterous hearts, which turned away from me, and by their eyes, which played the harlot after their idols. And they will loathe themselves in their own sight for the evils which they have committed, for all their abominations." So the picture here is God sending them into exile because they have committed a kind of spiritual adultery by turning away from him and pursuing pagan idols. Well, as I just said, after they returned from Babylon, there was a new emphasis on keeping the law amongst the religious leadership. That was the passionate mission of the Pharisees. And yet, as we continually see in Matthew, Jesus sees the religiousness of the Pharisees as a cover for a deeper kind of godlessness. I mean, this starts in Matthew. We've seen it starting in the Sermon on the Mount, and it has just been a continual theme that we've seen as we go along. And here, in response to the Pharisees and the scribes' demand for a sign, Jesus calls them an evil and adulterous generation, which is, that's that language from the prophets again, adulterous. But this time, it is a new pious kind of adultery. It is a kind of idolatry, but it is not an explicit, "I'm going running after pagan idols," but it is rather that more general concept of worldliness, running off after what the world has to offer instead of God. I think this is the kind of thing that James means when he says in James 4:4, "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." And that's a point that Jesus makes time and time again, that the Pharisees were worldly people. They practiced their religion before men. They pray and give alms and fast in such a way that they can be seen by everybody as doing it, because, as Jesus says, in doing that, they have their reward in full. They got what they were looking for. They were not praying because they were really all that interested in reaching out to God. They were praying because they liked what they got in this world from the approval of people who saw them as being pious and religious people. They liked the feeling of being admired for their religious devotion, and they liked the feeling of admiring themselves for their religious devotion. And self-righteousness is another aspect of it that Jesus talks about a lot. They even are described as being lovers of money, that a lot of their religious activity in one way or the other is involved with finding a reward in this world. The Messiah is right in front of them, and they can't see him because they are evil and adulterous. So it's a more sophisticated kind of adultery that we're talking about here, but in a way even more insidious because it's sort of hidden. This is what John records Jesus as saying to the Pharisees in John 5:8. "You do not have his word abiding in you, for you do not believe him whom he sent." That is, you don't believe in me. "You search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is these that testify about me. And you are unwilling to come to me so that you may have life. I do not receive glory from men, but I know you, that you do not have the love of God in yourselves. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another came in his own name, you will receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God?" And the key ideas there are that they are diligent students of the scriptures. They were known for this. That's what the scribes of the Pharisees were, students of the law and teaching the law and writing on the law. So they're diligent students of the scriptures. They know them backwards and forwards, but they're looking right at the Messiah and they don't see him and they don't want him. And why is it that Jesus says that they don't see him, they don't know who it is? Because they are unwilling. They don't want to. And why are they unwilling? As he says, they care more about what other people think of them than what God thinks of them. They are deeply concerned that those important people among the religious leadership of the Jews would look at them and approve of them and think highly of them, much more caring about that than what God would think about what they're doing. And it is because of that, it is because that that is what they're committed to, that they do not believe in Jesus. He says, how can you believe? It wouldn't even be possible for you to believe because you have something else that you're looking for. Well, this is a spiritual disaster that we're talking about. These are a people steeped in the religion of God, the religion of taught in the Old Testament, but they are very far from God and they don't know it. They are presenting themselves as champions of God even as they are hostile to what he is essentially about. And that's what Jesus has been saying about them all along, and that is what has them as essentially kind of as the forward vanguard of what ungodliness can do to you. Which brings me to point four. This culminates in a national rejection of the Messiah. Peter in Acts, the first sermon that Peter gives in Acts chapter 2, he says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death." And he ends, "Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified." So this is the final fruition of that unwillingness to repent before God. Now, we see two things here. This sermon in Acts, it also supports the point that I was making earlier about the remnant. There are 3,000 people who respond to this sermon by Peter, and they're all Jews. They have all come for the day of Pentecost, and they are there in Jerusalem, and they hear this, and here are 3,000 Jews responding to the apostle of Jesus. But the thing that he describes here, that the people have, through the hands of ungodly men, through the Romans, have put to Jesus to death, the leadership and the nation as a whole never repented of that. They congratulated themselves for having gotten rid of somebody who was a real pest. So this is the strongest and deepest expression of how far the nation has wandered from God. Outwardly pious, but inwardly so hostile to God that they kill the Messiah and his messengers. That is why Jesus can make this terrifying statement to the Pharisees later in Matthew. There's a section of teaching, the woes that Jesus pronounces on the Pharisees, that are so strong, it's really difficult to read in a sense. It is a very powerful denunciation. But it ends, Jesus says, "Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how will you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." So, I mean, this very strong language is basically showing how the rejection of the Messiah is based on a hostility toward God, an essentially adulterous attitude towards God that culminates in the rejection and death of the Messiah, which is the most extreme expression of violent hostility toward God that you're going to find. So the guilt of all of these different actions, all of the different times when someone was killed because they were on God's side, this is like the culmination of that. Now, is that true for every Jew who was living at the time? Absolutely not. But as a nation, we're asking the question, is this the time when God's going to come in and say, now I'm going to bless you and establish you in the land and kick the Romans out and so on? No, because this is the strongest expression that you will find of not living under that covenant, not submitting to God, repenting before God, and so on. So we have this strange tension where, on the one hand, we have individual Jews, like the apostles and many others, who are faithful to God. They embrace Jesus as the Messiah. They live their lives then in a sincere, from the heart commitment to God and to what he's doing through Jesus. At the same time that the nation as a whole has walked away from the relationship to God that God had called them to. And all this killing is being done by people who are doing it as pious, righteous people who are supposedly following God. As Jesus says to his disciples in John 16:2, "They will make you outcasts from the synagogue, but an hour is coming for everyone who kills you to think that he is offering service to God." And so, that is the unique sort of culmination of evil and adultery that the nation as a whole finds itself in, as far as you can get from what God had called them to in the Mosaic Covenant. They have embraced a religion without repentance, the worst thing in the world, leading ultimately to hating and killing the Messiah. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that I think that Jesus is talking about when he talks about this evil and adulterous generation. This generation is not the generation that has repented as a nation and turned to God and said, we have been in the wrong. This is the generation that as a nation has taken idolatry of a sort to a new sophisticated height and called it piety, called it religion. So that's the kind of thing that Jesus is saying, even at the same time that he's making the appeal, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And many Jews are hearing that response and coming to him and finding rest. Okay, so returning to the text here then, Jesus rejects their demand that he prove himself through this incontestable sign, this spectacular miracle that would prove that he's the Messiah. He sees this demand rooted in their evil, adulterous hearts. We have already seen in Matthew plenty of reasons why they should have responded to Jesus in belief. I mean, we've been seeing this argument from the beginning, the various reasons that people do not respond to the clear thing that God is doing in front of them. Their demand is not an innocent request for knowledge. It is a stubborn refusal to deal honestly with what they already know. So, Jesus says the only sign that they will get will be the sign of Jonah. What does that mean? That is a really hard question. This is a very hard question. So I'm going to tell you where I am right now. I've been thinking about maybe getting like a meter or something that I would wear on a hat that would kind of show you my level of confidence in the things that I say when I'm up here. Every now and again, when it dips down into the red, everybody kind of goes, oh, I better write that down. Don't put too much stock in that one. So I don't know. That would be a good question. Where on the meter is it? I'm not quite sure. Let me tell you why this is a tricky topic. First of all, Matthew gives in verse 40 what seems to be an explanation of what Jesus means, and this is in Jesus' mouth, the sign of Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. So it kind of seems like in Matthew that the focus is here. This is the explanation for what I mean by the sign of Jonah. And so then we try to figure out what that relationship is there. Interestingly, Luke has a very similar version of this section with the order a little bit differently and so on, but he doesn't have that part. He doesn't have the verse that says, for just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. He doesn't have that. That seems like an important part to leave out, actually, if you're trying to understand what it is that Jesus is saying here. What Luke has instead is, for just as Jonah became a sign to the Ninevites, so will the Son of Man be to this generation. That seems like a different sort of thing that's being said there. And there are many, many different explanations for how do we relate those two things and what do each one of them mean. Some interpretations then focus on the sign, the 3 days and three nights in the belly of the fish. So they would focus the sign of Jonah, what he's talking about is his death and resurrection, that he was only in the grave for 3 days and then he came out. And that's the sign that he's talking about. But others would look at Luke and say, well, Jonah became a sign to the Ninevites. What does that mean? Well, that's focusing like on his preaching and his message of condemnation and repentance and so on, right? Okay, so then they would put the emphasis there. And so as I was looking into this week, I found, I don't know how many, but a number of different permutations that people put on how exactly do you explain what's happening with this. So let me tell you what makes sense to me right now. Right now, I see this as being very similar to John 2:18, which I think is easier to understand what is happening there. This is the story, John's version of the casting out of the money changers from the temple. And as you can imagine, this gets some people upset when Jesus does that. And so in John 2:18, it says, "The Jews then said to him, 'What sign do you show us as your authority for doing these things?' Jesus answered them, 'Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.' The Jews then said, 'It took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?' But he was speaking of the temple of his body. So when he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken." So it's a similar request, and only in this particular case, they're asking for a sign because he just did this audacious thing of going into the temple and whipping the animals to drive them out and throwing the money on the ground and all of this stuff. So, you know, it's basically, who do you think you are? And could you please show us your credentials for doing a thing like this? That is, show us a sign. Let's have the heavens open and God say, yeah, I wanted him to do that. And so Jesus says, okay, I will show you a sign. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And what he means, we're told, is when he's talking about the temple, he's talking about himself. And essentially what he's saying is, if you kill me, in 3 days I will rise again. That's what he's saying. I have a side comment. I always make this side comment when looking at this thing because it's so fascinating to me. When we think about Jesus as a teacher and the way he communicated and how difficult it is to understand him at times, think about this scenario. He says that, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Evidently, not one single human being there understood what he meant. Because the disciples didn't understand what he meant because they didn't figure it out until after the resurrection. They're thinking back on it and they're going, oh, remember that time when he said, destroy the temple and in 3 days I will raise it up? 3 days. Oh, yeah. That's what he was talking about. Okay, so they were on his side and they didn't understand what he was talking about. And certainly the people at the temple, the Pharisees and Sadducees and stuff, they didn't understand what was going on. So it's one of those kind of situations where I think Jesus probably knew that he was going to say something that only he himself understood what it was he was talking about. So if you ever find yourself wondering if you're, maybe, is it just me? Am I having trouble understanding what Jesus said here? Am I somehow slow or something? Maybe sometimes, but most of the time, no, it's not you, it's him. He is being very cryptic a lot of the times. Anyway, okay, so in this scenario, what is it that's happening? They ask for a sign. He points to what I would say is the sign of all signs, his resurrection. The fact that he rises from the dead is the demonstration, miraculous certification of God saying, yeah, I'm with him. This is my Messiah. It is a truly miraculous sign. But it doesn't do them any good at the moment. I mean, it's not something that they can see right then. In fact, if you step back and think about it, it's actually a very complex thing he's saying. Because when he says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up, what he's saying is, you guys kill me and I will come back. And that's in fact essentially what happened. They killed him and then he came back. So far from giving them a sign right there that convinces them, oh yeah, you do have the authority, go ahead and knock over some more stalls with money in them. He does not do that, and the dissatisfaction of the religious leadership only grows and grows, and ultimately it leads to his death. And then the sign happens, which is the resurrection. So when he says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up, essentially he's saying, no, I'm not going to show you a sign. I don't got to show you no stinking bodges, if anybody knows that movie. So the thrust of what it is that he's saying is, okay, yeah, I will show you a sign, which is to say I'm not going to show you a sign. But there is a sign, but that sign is, in fact, in the future, and it may be, in fact, too late for you because you may be one of the guys that end up arranging for me to be dead. so that the sign can happen. Okay, so as kind of reinforcement, the message of the apostles throughout the rest of the New Testament focuses on the sign power of the resurrection, if you know what I mean by that. That the purpose of the resurrection really is, in part, to be that authenticating thing. If you look at the message of the apostles throughout Acts and look at Paul's letters and everybody's letters, a lot of times the essential apostolic message is Jesus is the Christ and God demonstrated this by raising him from the dead. How do you know? I'm telling you, Jesus is the Christ. How do you know? God raised him from the dead. That's their message. So I am inclined to see the explanation that he gives about Jonah and 3 days in the belly of the fish as pointing to the resurrection. And it is, in fact, a genuine sign that Jesus is pointing to. But just like in John, here he's saying more explicitly, I'm not going to give you a sign. The only sign I will give you is the sign of Jonah. And what he means by that is he could have said, the only sign I will give you is destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. It's the same sort of thing. He is pointing to the fact that he is only going to be 3 days in the grave, in the earth. But he's not going to give them the sort of sign that they're asking for. There's not going to be a sky full of angels singing, listen to Jesus, or something like that. Okay, now, why does he compare his burial and resurrection to Jonah's being swallowed by the fish? Why describe it in those terms? I'm not exactly sure. There are a couple reasons that make some sense to me. First reason is there is a certain similarity between them. When the fish swallowed him, Jonah was as good as dead. I mean, if you saw him fall in the water and get swallowed by a fish, you thought, oh, well, there goes Jonah. He was a nice guy. He's gone. And yet, 3 days later, he emerges alive. Well, same thing is true for Jesus. He literally was dead when he was put in the earth. But likewise, he's only there for 3 days, and then he emerged alive. It also helps to set up the allusion that Jesus makes to the preaching of Jonah. If you notice what we're looking at here, he follows this by talking about how the Ninevites responded to Jonah and his preaching, and then he talks about the Queen of Sheba and Solomon. So these Gentile Ninevites responded to Jonah. This Gentile queen responded to Solomon. Jesus the Messiah is greater than Jonah and Solomon, and yet the Jews as a nation have not responded to Jesus. So it kind of hangs together, and it sets him up for what it is he's about to say. This, by the way, this talking about the Ninevites and the Queen of Sheba would have been seen as a powerful put down by Jesus. He is speaking to people who see themselves as the culmination of pious Jewish godliness, and yet Jesus says that they will be judged by these Gentiles who responded to God's man better than they have. The Gentile Ninevites responded to God's man, Jonah. The Gentile Queen of Sheba responded to God's man, Solomon. But you, the so-called pious culmination of Jewish religiosity, you are looking right at your Messiah and you have rejected him. Okay, so right now that's the way I'm inclined to take it, but there are a lot of things we could talk about. This comment applies to the next one that is even harder than that one. You know, we get up here, by we, I mean Jack and David and myself, and we talk about these passages. And what we're doing in each of these cases is we're looking at it and we're asking the question, you know, what is it that makes the most sense out of the details that we have here? And I don't know. It probably gets wearisome all of the times that I say, well, I'm not sure about this or I'm not sure about that. But it's important to me to make it clear to you that I'm aware that these are judgment calls. That is, there are certain factors. And sometimes if I listen to somebody else talking about some passage and they go this way, and I think, I can't really go that way. Why don't I? I mean, are they just stupid? Are they, you know, I don't want to be a stupid person like that. I want to be a smart person, so I'm going to go this way. No, not at all. It's, there are these factors. And how much do you weigh those factors in putting this together? So I'm aware that, say, for example, about the sign of Jonah and what I just said, I'm pretty sure that years ago when Jack was talking in Luke, I went and listened to some of it to kind of see what, you know, Jack didn't say what I just said. He said something completely different, I think, if I'm getting that right. Okay, well, why? Well, because I listened. I mean, I said, because there are certain parts that you emphasize this over that, and then if you say, okay, this part seems to be important, then you kind of lean in that direction. I'm mentioning this because it is an unavoidable part of the process. Part of the reason that I talk about that meter that I could wear the hat as to how confident I am about things is there are those times when the factors kind of line up pretty well. And I feel like I could make my case. I could say, look at these things. This is all lining up in this way. This has got to be what's going on here. And when I hear another argument on the other side, I say, yeah, but see, the problem with that is this doesn't work and this doesn't work. And I think it makes a great deal of sense to emphasize these factors here. And so I feel fairly confident. At other times, you have that sense of, well, it seems to me like the emphasis ought to come down here. And so some of those other factors that seem to be going a little other places, I'm going to explain them in a slightly different way because it seems like this is coming down here. But somebody else can come along and say, no, you see, the thing is you need to emphasize these pieces over here. And that part that you're emphasizing is not really the most important part, and we can explain that away. That's what leads to those situations where people don't agree. And people of good faith, people who are trying their hardest to deal with the text the way it is, will come up with a different answer. So I think it's important for us to understand that because many, many years ago, when I started into the process of starting to try to understand the Bible and study the Bible, I did so standing on what seemed to me to be pretty solid theological ground, which was my salvation does not depend on how many right answers I get as I'm reading the Bible. I am putting my confidence in God, and the reason that I am striving to understand the Bible is because this is God's word. But it's clear that we don't always come to the same conclusions about this stuff, and I can live with that. I can live with uncertainty. I can live with saying, I'm not quite sure what this passage says, because I am not uncertain about God and his ability to save me. So I think it's important for us to be honest about the fact that we have more or less levels of certainty as we are looking at these things, because we need to be aware that ultimately, you know, when you're here, I hope you're not going away thinking, now I have heard the answer, and now I can go and take that and use it and do whatever I'm going to do with it. Someday, we should probably have a deal where first I teach on a passage, and then Jack teaches on a passage, and then David teaches on a passage, and you could go away going, oh, I get it. I see how this works. Because sometimes, I mean, you're just going to find that they're not going to land in the same place. And it's because of that thing. It's because of that emphasis thing. So I'm putting emphasis on that verse 40 here, where the explanation that the sign of Jonah has something to do with the 3 days in the fish and the 3 days in the earth. and that the focus is there. And I'm also putting emphasis on the fact that I see the resurrection being given by Jesus as a sign and by the apostles as a sign. And that makes sense to me, that somehow that's at the focus of what he's trying to do here, with difficult details along the way. Okay, so, Verse 43. Now when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there, and the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. That is the way it will also be with this evil generation. Okay, so this is one of the weirdest things in the entire Bible. I knew I was coming to where I was going to have to talk about this passage. I thought, how in the world am I going to talk about this passage? There are a number of ways you can go with this story. I have a way right now which tentatively makes a certain amount of sense to me in understanding it. So I want to explain to you what that is and how I would get there. Again, it's this matter of what do you find to be the most significant pieces as you put this together. First of all, it's interesting that Matthew has one piece that Luke does not. In Luke's parallel passage, Matthew ends the story, that is the way it will also be with this evil generation. Luke ends it, the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. So, but Matthew ends it, the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. That is the way it will also be with this evil generation. I think that's a significant comment at the end. I think that gives us some information about what's going on. First of all, it seems to me to fairly clearly suggest that this is not a literal description of an exorcism. That's not what we're talking about here. Although you'd be surprised how many commentaries I found that do think that it is essentially a literal description of an exorcism. Jesus' advice is, when I cast a demon out of you, you better be careful, or pretty soon some others will come back and it'll be real bad. But it seems to me that that statement would suggest that that's not what's being talked about, that somehow this is a picture that applies to that entire evil generation. So it's some sort of an analogy or metaphor or allegory, some sort of a symbolic statement that says, this is what's going to happen to this generation. It also suggests to me that this story is meant to apply not to individual believers, but to the nation as a whole. The last state of the man becomes worse than the first. That is, this evil generation will come to be in a state that is worse than the first. So that is the direction that I'm leaning in, the way that I understand this. Next, I think a key concept in this strange little story is the word unoccupied. The man here is pictured like being a house. So the unclean spirit has a house, and he's living in his house, which is the man. Then the unclean spirit is kicked out and homeless, and he's wandering in the wilderness. The language about waterless places, if you look in the Septuagint, it's a common way of referring to that situation of being out in the wilderness, not having a home. You know, being out there, needing to find your way back to where there is shelter and water and food and so on. Okay, so he's kicked out, he's homeless, he gets this idea, hey, I think I'll go check out my old house, see if there's anything going on there. And when he comes back, he finds he can live in his old house because it is unoccupied. And that's what I think is the point here, is that if the house had been occupied with something better than the evil spirit, then the evil spirit would come back and say, oh, there's somebody living there already, stuck. But because it's unoccupied, he can move back in, and he brings seven of his buddies, and now the second situation is worse than the first. Okay, so I think the picture is of something bad, something evil being removed, but nothing takes its place, and so in time it comes back even worse. Something like that is what's being talked about here. So here are the pieces that I'm trying to put together that seem to make some sense to me as being the key features. We are talking about the nation. Something evil was kicked out, but nothing good came to replace it. And so this evil generation will find itself in an even worse situation. That's where I'm headed as I'm thinking about this. Now, along those guidelines then, what immediately comes to mind to me, and this may not be the way to go, but this is a way that makes some sense to me, is I think about Israel's story of sin and judgment. The nation, we were talking about this before, the nation was faithless and adulterous in its godless and idolatrous ways. This ended in the disaster of judgment through the conquest and captivity in Babylon. Then, so that was a great evil that ended in a bad way. Then God brought them back to the land, and there is this new emphasis on keeping the law that emerged. They had been punished with exile for not keeping the Sabbath, for example. Well, now they're going to keep the Sabbath. So the evil spirit of lawbreaking was cast out. And the Pharisees emerged as the dominant players in the religious life and education of Israel. But true repentance and faithfulness did not come in to replace the old godlessness. The religious leadership was big on keeping the law, but they were still evil and adulterous. Only now, it was a godless worldliness that was covered over with so-called godliness and law-keeping. And it culminated in hearts so hard that they reject and in the end kill the Messiah. With the end result that once again, God judges them with exile, but this time even worse. So, summing up the picture that I'm talking about here. Israel had a spirit of overt godlessness and idolatry. They suffered severe judgment and exile because of it. This led them to abandon overt godlessness and idolatry, but a true spirit of repentance did not replace it. Therefore, a covert godlessness and idolatry took its place, which is worse. Ultimately, they came to reject the Messiah, or they will reject the Messiah, as Jesus is speaking here, because of it, and God will judge them with a worse exile once again. So the last state is worse than the first. If pressed, this is how I would explain this strange little story right now. I don't have a great deal of confidence in it, but it's the best I have ever done in coming up with something that makes sense to me about what's going on in this story. There are other ways to go. 40 years ago, I heard Jack explain this story quite differently. Most of you know my story, but you know, Jack had this huge influence on me back in the early days of my becoming a Christian. Jack had a class on biblical interpretation that I just ate it up. I went to every class. I did all the assignments that he gave and everything. Sometimes he would give an assignment, go away and think about this passage. And I couldn't wait for a week to find out what it was he was going to say. And I would see, oh, he's going to be teaching on the other side of the valley at this church, and he's going to talk about this passage. I'm going. And I would drive across the valley so that I could go and hear what Jack was going to say about this passage. Because I was on fire to learn about this stuff. So back then, Jack described this. He mentioned how weird it was, because it is, and described it in a certain way. It's not anything like what I just said. So there are certainly other ways to go. But hopefully you can see what I'm talking about, how it depends on what you emphasize. I am saying that language, this is the way it will be with this evil generation, that is a significant statement. That what he's saying is, this picture that I have just painted that ends up with a situation where your last state is worse than the first. You had this bad thing, you got rid of it, but in the end you end up with something even worse because you didn't put something good in its place. I'm saying, okay, that statement saying that's about this evil generation, that's a key in the way I'm thinking about this. I'm saying, okay, this is a general statement about the nation and its trajectory and the way it has done things, and not a particular statement about here's what happens to a particular unbeliever when he has a certain kind of problem or something like that. If I'm wrong to put that emphasis there, then I'm really way off in the way I'm going. But that's what I'd like you to understand. It is those decisions that affect the way we go with these things, which is why, for all the best will in the world, none of us are ever going to ultimately agree about everything when it comes to the Bible. And it's important for us to understand that. We don't want to be skeptics and say, oh, we'll never figure anything out in the Bible. I had a brief moment in my life when I was tempted to embrace that skepticism. Oh, nobody is ever going to figure anything out about the Bible. And what God did for me is he brought along Jack's biblical interpretation class. After taking that for a year, at the end I said, okay, no, I don't think that's right. I think we can make some progress in figuring out stuff. And I have believed that deeply ever since. And I feel like I've demonstrated it to myself over the past 40 years. But I've also demonstrated to myself that we're just not all going to agree about everything. So you may not agree with me about what I just said about this strange little story about the unclean spirit, and I will never speak to you again, but what are you going to do? Okay, so finally, the last one, simple, easy, just a quick comment about it. The chapter ends, while he was still speaking to the crowds, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. Someone said to him, behold, your mother and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you. But Jesus answered the one who was telling him and said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother. Okay, the interesting word in this little story is the word mother. Now, imagine that this story had been, Jesus' brothers are at the door. Jesus says, who are my brothers? Whoever does the will of my Father, he is my brother. We would be very familiar with that language. If we have the same father as Jesus, then we are his brothers, and we use that language, the Bible uses that language. Christians use that kind of language all the time about we are brothers, and we are brothers of Christ. He is our brother. We use that language. I am not used to thinking of myself as Jesus' mother. That is not my typical way of thinking about who I am. But I think that that language actually helps us to see more clearly what it is that he's getting at. First of all, we can picture the situation. Someone interrupts Jesus as he's teaching to say, hey, your mother and your brothers, they're at the door. They want to talk to you. Your family is out there, right? And we all know how that kind of thing works. This is a pretty universal sort of human experience, because your family, that's your people. The members of your family are the people that are yours. They're the people that know you. They are hopefully on your side. It's not always the case, but when families are working the way we would like them to work, they are the people, you know, like they say, you know, home is that place where they have to let you in when you go there, you know. These are the people that are mine. I have a connection with them that is stronger than I do with other people. So the expectation here is, hey, Jesus, your people are here at the door. I expect you'll want to stop and go talk to them. I'll cover for you. You know, I'll do some jokes with the crowd while you go talk to your mom and your brothers, because I'm sure you need to do that, because those are your folks, right? I mean, I understand, you know, those are your people. So I think Jesus is hitchhiking on that idea that our families are the people that we have the strongest connection to, and he's saying, no, my strongest connection is with my disciples. That sense you have that your mother and your brothers are your people, the people that you have the closest, most important connection to, that's how I feel about those who, like me, are seeking to do the will of God. So when Jesus says, that's the one who is my brother and sister and mother, he's saying, that's the one who is part of my real family. These are the people that I feel have the the most important connection with me. This is a very common idea in the New Testament. It gets talked about all the time. Two implications to this. First of all, there is this great comfort that comes from this idea that we are accepted as his family by Jesus. It had to feel great when Jesus stretched out his hand to say, "These are my people here." I mean, if I had been one of the disciples, I would have thought, "Oh, wow. He's looking at me when he said that." So, and you and I are in fact included in that gesture. Jesus claims us as members of his family. We are part of his family. So that's a great thing. But also, I think he is modeling for us how we are meant to think about other believers. You are my people. If we think about the real situation, then I have a stronger connection to you in some ways, in the most significant way, than I do to my natural family. And this is a very common theme in the New Testament. The more I see myself as one who is forgiven by God and blessed with a great destiny, the more I identify with others in the same position. You have heard me say that over and over and over again, because every time I go teaching something in the New Testament, I bump up against this idea again, because everybody talks about it. Jesus talks about it all the time, and the apostles talk about it. This is a big theme. Okay, well, I left you a whole 5 minutes.
I just have a question about the word generation.
Yes.
The word that's translated generation. Is that specifically the people who lived when Jesus was there, or does that include us?
Yeah. Okay, if we talk about word meaning, it is possible for this word generation to mean a group of people like a race or a nation or something like that, which is tangentially related to your question. This word is debated in the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus is describing the destruction of the temple and all of that stuff and a whole series of things, and he makes that statement, "This generation will not pass away until all these things are fulfilled." And so part of the debate is, what did he mean by that? And in what sense is that happening? So it is a question that has to be answered. I went and did a fair amount of, I tried to look at the ways it was used in the New Testament and some in the Old Testament, and I'm pretty convinced that it is basically what you would think. He's talking about this is the generation of Jews who are living at the time that he has arrived. I mean, that's clear when he says, you know, the Ninevites will stand at the judgment and judge this generation because they repented at the teaching of Jonah, and behold, something greater than Jonah is here. So they're going to judge this generation, that is you guys, because they had Jonah, you have me. So I'm pretty sure that throughout the whole thing that what he means is those who are around, the Jews who are around at that time seeing him and interacting with him, I think is what he means. Yeah.
I'm curious about their asking for a sign or demanding a sign from him.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like they're sort of throwing down the gauntlet,
mm-hmm.
and they're saying, you need to submit to our authority, and we're gonna demand of you an act that if you don't, quote unquote, pass our test, we have the right to reject you. We have the authority to reject you. Almost as if they had something in store that they would demand of him that they knew he wouldn't do, so that they could disqualify him before the crowd.
Yeah, I'm inclined to see it that way too. I mean, you could take it as this sort of, hey, you're implying some pretty strong claims for yourself. Let's slow down here. Let's have a sign. But I think that language about testing him and that kind of stuff is usually, those pictures are exactly like, the point is they're trying to see what he's made of, see if they can find the problem with what it is that he's saying. So I'm inclined to see it in that way. I'm not totally sure. But what is clear is that Jesus believes that their demand for a sign is rooted in something bad. That is, it's not an honest question that says, why should I believe in you? Help me understand why, you know, what's going on here. He thinks that they're at that place where they need proof because they have not dealt righteously and honestly with what they have had to work with. So
he's done some pretty amazing things, mm-hmm. and many people from different walks of life have been converted to belief because of it.
Yeah,
it's just strange to me that they don't just go along and say, well, it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. I mean, right. Isn't this the sort of thing God would do?
Yeah. Well, remember, we're not that far from the part in Matthew where he was saying to Capernaum, you know, if the miracles that were done among you had been done in Sodom, you know, they wouldn't have. So his perspective is that he has done, especially in the Galilean region where I think we still are, where when this is this thing that we're talking about here, they have seen more than enough. If they were looking at it from a perspective of desiring to know God and being honest about God and themselves, that they would say, that's a person from God, I need to find out what he's doing. In that sense, he's made it pretty clear that the decision not to believe in him is not an innocent one, especially among the leadership.
And so if they are both evil and adulterous, that's why they crave a sign. We don't refer to Thomas the Doubter as an evil and adulterous man.
No.
Because he said, I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
So,
right? Right.
And so it seems to me they're on the other side. They're playing for the other team, is his point.
Yeah.
They're not weak. They're not begging to be convinced. They're revealing the fact that they want nothing to do with him.
Yeah, I don't think he's saying the very fact that you asked for a sign is proof that you have evil and adulterous hearts. What he's saying is the reason you're asking me for a sign is that you have evil and adulterous hearts. That in your situation, you have more than enough information to know what to do with this here. So the fact that you won't go there is significant. It says something about where you're coming from, which is just exactly that thing in John that he was saying. You've studied the scriptures, you know all about this stuff, but you don't see me, and that's because there's something going on inside. You want something else.